when I call this a romp, that's important because he's so multifaceted. Porphyry of Tyre, his dates 232 probably, to 309, and he came from Phoenicia, which is roughly speaking modern Lebanon. Though we see that he was at some time in his childhood in Carthage. But Carthage was a trading city. The Phoenicians were great tradespeople. Indeed, they set up colonies in some of their trading cities and cities they traded with. And I think that may have been true of Carthage. It was an incredibly cosmopolitan era. Indeed, a lot of late antiquity and indeed the early Islamic Middle Ages were incredibly cosmopolitan compared with us. I mean, we have a great deal of are they a Christian or are they Muslim? Absolutely reverse. I mean, it was delightful. Something for us to emulate. And he was an avid reader and scholar of many religions, including Jewish and Christian religion, though he was a pagan. He'd obviously read up the Zoroastrians, he read up the Egyptians, he was interested, but skeptical about the Chaldean oracles, and so on. How many other of our Greek philosophers studied the Zoroastrians? His name, Malchus, the original name, meant king, but he was called Porphyry because he came from Tyre. Porphyry means purple, and purple, the purple dye came from Tyre. He studied first with Longinus, who had moved from Athens to join the patroness of philosophers, Zenobia, in Palmyra, which was somewhat nearer him than Athens. But eventually he came to join Plotinus in Rome. And so the first thing on the handout is his description of what it was like getting into Plotinus' seminar. And actually we can now envisage this with incredible vividness. Because although I don't for a moment say that the teaching room that Plotinus used in Rome was like the one that's now been beautifully excavated, or rather the 20 lecture rooms, or more now, that have been excavated in Alexandria. But Alexandria helps you to imagine it, because you can see in Alexandria that the professor sat on elevated throne at the back. There was a horseshoe shape of stone tiers or benches for the students, curved so that everybody could see everybody. But the one person, often a student at the beginning of the seminar, at least in the case of Plotinus' lectures, was out at a lectern in the mouth of the horseshoe in a very exposed position, and that's what Porphyry describes his first attempt to make an impression in Plotinus' seminar. I, Porphyry, experienced something of the sort when I first heard him, Plotinus. So the result was that I wrote against him in an attempt to show that the object of thought existed outside the intellect. He made Aemilius, up to that point the best student, of course, best student can reverse, of course, he made Aemilius read this essay to him, and when the reading was finished, smiled and said, "You shall have the task of solving these difficulties, Aemilius." Everybody was on their toes, of course. "He has fallen into them because he does not know what we hold. Aha!" Aemilius wrote a lengthy treatise in answer to Porphyry's difficulties. I replied to what he had written. Aemilius answered my reply. The third time, I with difficulty understood the doctrine, changed my mind, and wrote a recantation, which I read in the meeting of the school. After this, I believed in Plotinus's writings and tried to rouse in the master himself the ambition to organize his doctrine and write it down more at length. And Aemilius also stimulated his desire to write books, although Aemilius' edition didn't survive and Porphyry's did, the one we use now. This is written in Porphyry's life of Plotinus. He created the canon of writings that we have now. He arranged them, he cut them up into bits, he put ones with the same topic together. To some extent, they get more complicated as they go along. He was an editor in that sense, and not in the sense of a modern editor trying to find the best possible text. Although a new paper, I didn't know if it's out yet, by Myrto Hatzimachali, says that that had been actually going on even BC, quite a lot of editing in the modern sense. This wasn't editing in the modern sense. This was another very important sort of job, making a canon of the Tanis' writings, both making sure he wrote them down, but also then arranging them in an intelligible order, which we follow now. But he accompanied that with a biography, a life of Plotinus, full of the most intimate details. I don't think I'll tell you about his bowels, but we do learn that he refused to be weaned until he was 8 years old. Do read on, if you don't know it very well already. Now, a very, very important thing that Porphyry did was to argue for the harmony of Greek philosophers. They agreed with each other. So Plato and Aristotle agreed with each other. Very nice book by George Karamanolis has traced this idea from Antiochus in the first century BCE all the way to Porphyry. So it wasn't a new idea. But it was very important that the first Neoplatonist commentator on Aristotle took this view so strongly. Took this view in reply to his master Plotinus. Because Plotinus spent Ennead six, or 1 to 3, apparently attacking Aristotle's categories for talking about substance, but not applying it to Platonic forms, which are surely primary substances, and not discussing them at all. It looks like an attack. And what Porphyry does is to say, look, there's no need for Platonists to reject Aristotle. Aristotle's a preliminary to reading Plato. He's talking about the world down here because he's talking about the ordinary uses of language, which tend to refer to sensible objects, perceptible objects. So he's talking about the perceptible world. This is a very necessary preliminary to study the intelligible world of Plato. One person, great Pierre Hadot, thinks he went a little further. It's not his own writing, but it's a pupil of a pupil, a commentator on Aristotle called Dexippus. He tells us in the categories, and this is actually my second piece on the handout, the description of this kind of substance down here, perceptible substances, that it's neither said of nor present in anything else, because it's a subject. So it's not like beautiful or human, which have to be said of or present in an individual substance. So in the categories of Aristotle, but not in his later work, but in the categories of Aristotle, the hallmark of a primary substance is that it's an ultimate subject, which isn't in its turn a predicate of something further. And what Dexippus is saying is that this can be applied to the other two also. Now, one obvious reading is that this is not repeating Porphyry's view, but Iamblichus's view, which has just been described. Iamblichus's view was that Plotinus got it wrong because Aristotle intended, supposedly, that the notion of substance, as defined in the categories, would apply by analogy to Plato's thoughts. But here analogy is left out. So Pierre Hadot thinks that perhaps this is what Porphyry said. It's a conjecture anyway. But if so, he'd be going as far as saying, Porphyry would have gone as far as saying, my master Plotinus, in the end, offered a reply to his own objections. I must say, his own objections take up a tremendous amount of space, and this reply here, recorded by Dexippus, takes up 2 lines. So I find it a little implausible, but it's a possibility. Now, because he said, look, Plato and Aristotle really agree. Reading one is not some alternative to reading the other. Porphyry put Aristotle on the map forever. He's really never got off the map. He got learned from Tolstoy. I mean, his works did. But that's not always successful. And so that really put Aristotle on the map too, aren't they? Now, I'll start with the most charming of all Porphyry's works, my favourite, Porphyry on Abstinence, translated by Gillian Sharp with wonderful notes. I do recommend you buy that book. It's my favourite of all the translations I've got, actually. Now, it's got four parts to it. In the first, he records the amazing arguments on both sides for and against killing animals in the ancient world. It wasn't like Christianity, it was evenly balanced. I mean, already Pythagoras is forbidding somebody to beat a dog because he recognized a friend's voice when the dog barked. Or Empedocles says that he's being punished by being reincarnated as a mere human because he ate meat in the previous life, so he's probably eating his grandmother. And so, because of reincarnation. So, you see, it was very evenly balanced, this debate. In fact, the Christ was a meat eater, or very much a fish eater, that made Christianity rather different in this matter. The first part is the arguments for and against, even the second part is on the gods. If you understood the gods, you'd realize they're immaterial beings who don't want material sacrifices. They want the sacrifice of a pure mind. It sounds rather almost Christian, except pure heart, I think you find, because of the Hebrew, pure heart. Third part, look at animals and you'll find that, contrary to the Stoics, animals are rational like us. That's where we learn that Porphyry was in Carthage as a little boy because he had a partridge. And this partridge, instead of making partridge noises, did Porphyry speak. That's a sign that some animals, at any rate, are rational, with which I 100% agree that some animals are rational. And so, if your criterion for who's owed justice is only rational, only the rational community is owed justice, and animals, or some animals, are in that community. That's an argument he uses in the third part. And finally, humans. He looks at all the nations he knows of who are vegetarian and are perfectly healthy. Nothing wrong with them. Brahmins in India are one. The Essene Jews are another, and so on. Very interesting anthropologically. By the way, Fergus Millis's favourite book in antiquity. Just as it is, just about nine. Yeah, late antiquity, I mean. Later. Now, we're going to hear, later in the term, a brilliant reinterpretation by G. Fay Edwards, as it seems to me. There are some parts of the view, I think, are more strongly argued than others, but a large part of that view has convinced me. Perhaps it won't convince you, and we shall all learn, including me. But that's one of the excitements to come, Fay Edwards. I'm going to read a bit, which is my next handout, from Porphyry on Abstinence. How stupid of me, I didn't underline it. But this is from 326 to 327 on the right-hand side of the first page. And he's saying that staying off meat helps you to be a just character. Gives you a just character. The god did not make it impossible, starting the second line, for us to save ourselves without injuring others, for that would be to give us a nature which was the origin of injustice. And indeed, those who have thought to derive justice from the appropriation of human beings have, it seems, failed to recognize the particular character of justice, for that would be a kind of philanthropy. He's talking about the Stoics. And the Stoics talked about not so much appropriation as a process of feeling affection for your fellow human beings in wider and wider circles. I wouldn't actually myself, but perhaps now translate it. It's absolutely perfectly correct, but I would probably be slightly less accurate. I'd probably look to paraphrase, at least depends which audience you're writing for. I think I would try and explain it by saying, I don't know what, I can't think of a good one now, but I want to convey the idea that you're supposed to spread the affection you naturally feel for people very close to you to all human beings, because there's the rational beings. That's a sort of paraphrase, maybe. It's not a translation, actually. The translation is done by Gillian. And he's objecting to him and saying, that's a philanthropy. That means all you're going to do is to love humans. But you should be loving animals as well. Whereas justice lies in restraint and harmlessness, ablabia. I won't translate it non-violence, that would be inaccurate on the Zion of Gandhi. Harmlessness, ablabia, towards everything that does not do harm. This is how the just man thinks, not that other way. So justice, since it lies in harmlessness, extends as far as living beings, animate beings. And there's more in 27. Actually, there's more in 26, but let's for speed go to 27. True justice is not safeguarded either when pleasure is the end, or when the primary goods in accordance with nature make up the sum of happiness, or at least, or all on offer. In most people, the movements and the needs of irrational nature are the beginning of injustice. For example, they need to eat animals, so they say, to keep nature from distress and not lacking what it desires. But when the end is the utmost possible assimilation to the God, he's very keen on assimilation to God, description of justice which comes out of Plato's Theaetetus. Harmlessness is safeguarded in all cases. A man who is led by the passions and is harmless only to his children and his wife, but contemptuous and aggressive towards others, is aroused and dazzled by mortal things as the irrational dominates him. I think the idea here is that if you could purify your passions, you would not only be assimilated to God, but you would reach justice. And that connects you with Theaetetus, because justice was assimilation to God. You would reach justice, why? Well, you see, if you don't have passions, like, I must have some meat, that's the one that's relevant here, but other passions too, you're not going to be unjust to other people, he says. You're not going to be unjust to animals, for a start. Kill them. To eat them. But also, you're not going to thieve, because you don't have a passion for money, or for wealth, or for property, or for that sort of thing. So you're going to be just to other people in every way. Now, I do have a complaint about this. I think it's a very negative view of justice. You see, I don't think that justice is a matter of just refraining from doing unjust things to people. I think the really just person has got to look out for other people's needs, including their bodily needs. And the next thing I'm going to say suggests, even more than this passage, that interest in bodily needs is going to be missing from this person who's purifying himself of bodily interests. Because there's a whole idea about levels of virtue already in Plato's Republic, very much taken up by the Neoplatonists. And it comes on the next page of the handout. They're starting at the top. He married late in life an elderly, well, not elderly, but a widow who'd been bereaved and left with four children to look after. And as he carefully explains to her in the letter to her, letter to Marcella, he married her not as a woman. I don't know of any other person who's written those words to his wife. And I don't know how many of the husbands would actually get away with it. But he obviously had made it clear from the very beginning that he was undertaking this in order to teach her Neoplatonist purified virtue, which pays no attention to the needs of the body, because it's risen above that. Well, I don't recommend anybody here trying that idea out, but Porphyry is teaching her in this letter how to achieve purified virtue, and he tells us most about it in a commentary on a bit of Plotinus in the so-called sentences, yes, John Dillon's translation. And it's matching the Republic, because you see at the very end of the Republic, after you've heard about the four virtues the Republic discusses, right at the end in Book 10, he says, of course, these are the virtues of the three-part soul, but if you could see the soul in its purity as just the rational part of the soul, which is the true soul, you'd see that actually virtue is something totally different. It would be a purified virtue according to the Neoplatonist terminology. It would be purified virtue, and we go to the Phaedo for that. Because, you see, Socrates has so purified himself of the ordinary desires for the body that he's not afraid of death unlike his companions. And that's actually mentioned here. The four virtues of the Republic have their purified form, and it's well worth reading this. I won't read it all now. These three or four pages by John Dillon. I will read one bit on page four, probably page four. I will read that one bit because it says something very interesting about six lines down on page four. Porphyry says, whoever possesses the superior virtues, we may note, also necessarily possesses the lower ones, but the converse is not the case. On the other hand, he who possesses the superior virtues will not, by reason of the fact that he possesses also the lower ones, conduct himself primarily in accordance with the lower ones, but will only do so in response to the circumstances which confront him in the realm of generation. So, in other words, once you've reached purified virtue, you're not going to be thinking all the time of, can I say it? Can I help this little old lady across the road? Will you? I mean, how are you going to be considering the mere bodily needs of this little old lady? He's not going to consider the bodily needs of his wife, certainly, that's for sure. He's told her in advance, and in a letter. I don't quite see how he's going to sufficiently consider other people's bodily needs, and I would have thought justice is not a purely negative thing, but it involves positively looking out for people's bodily and other needs. But he would think, I suppose, that it only involves looking out for the needs of their soul. Like in the Alcibiades, Socrates is only worried about the state of Alcibiades' soul, isn't it, not of his body. But people need their bodies thought by as well, I would say. And now, Porphyry was very interested in the idea of the relation between the soul and the body in something called the Sutimeta, miscellaneous essays. He uses a phrase which actually became rather popular, including in Christianity. He talks about the soul and the body being unified without fusion. You see, in fusion, you get a chemical mixture, so you no longer have what you started with. If soul and body were fused, you wouldn't any longer have a soul, you wouldn't any longer have a body, you'd have some third thing, because they'd be so perfectly mixed. So it's a mixture without fusion. But more interesting to me is a hypothesis I did put forward once in a book on the self. Because I was asking the question, how is it that two people, neither of whom could possibly have read the other, produced an argument so alike? I'm thinking of Augustine's use of the cogito in On the Trinity, and Ibn Sina, in 1200, his use of the flying man argument, to show that the essence of the self, or in Augustine's case, the essence of the soul, contains nothing bodily. The argument is like Descartes, though each argument is slightly different in the premises it uses, but there's a great similarity. Now, how could two people so different as Augustine, who wrote in Latin, and Ibn Sina, 1200, so 800 years later, who wrote in Persian and Arabic, and certainly would not have read Latin, though he had many translations of Greek, how could they come up with so similar an idea? Well, great minds do think alike. But I did suggest if there was a common source, Porphyry was the best because of the passage I put on page, top of page six. This is Porphyry's sentences. And actually, if we looked at sentences 40, the immediately preceding one, we'd find a phrase very close to Augustine in On the Trinity. He says, you are present to a self which is present to you. It's very like Augustine's phrase in the relevant passage of On the Trinity, which talks about the soul being present to itself. That might be one hint. I think it was pointed out by Dominic O'Mara that Augustine is reacting to Porphyry. But I'm taking this argument, which I've underlined it on page 6, top left-hand corner, but if something is able to know itself without that in which it resides, the body, in other words, withdrawing itself from that and being able to do so without being destroyed, then it cannot owe its essence to the thing from which it was able to turn into it, to turn itself to itself, without getting destroyed, and to know itself without that thing. And then he goes on to say, only intellect can do this, the senses can't do that. So the idea is, it's special about the intellect that it can know itself when it's turned totally away from the body. So it knows itself without having anything about the body in itself at all. And that shows that at least the essence of the intellect can't be bodily. The conclusion is very similar. Premises aren't quite the same, but they're all talking about the essence. You'll find Augustine's one in On the Trinity, where he does his cogito. He does a cogito version more than once, but at one place he uses it to show that the soul is not by essence bodily. And Avicenna does it, Avicenna does it with his flying man. Perhaps a few of you will know the flying man. But the flying man argument is this. Imagine yourself coming into existence, flying through the air, but not touching anything, so you feel nothing bodily. And let's say you're not seeing anything. You just feel. You just know you exist, even though you don't know that anything bodily exists, because you're not looking and you're not feeling anything. And then he uses this as a proof, this flying man. But therefore, the bodily can't be of your essence. It may be accidentally connected to you, perhaps very strongly for some reason, but it can't be of your essence, the essence of yourself. Well, if there was a common source, I think Porphyry would be the obvious one. He's very interested in soul and body. Now, Augustine is extremely interested in Porphyry, and we're going to hear about this from Gillian Clark later in the term. It's City of God, Book 10 in particular, and he does admit that Porphyry is much the best of the Platonists he knows about. He comes very close at some points to Christian doctrine, but unfortunately he contradicts himself and is forever attracted by terrible superstition. As you know, the bits of other people's religions you don't like you call superstition, but on no account. You won't say that about your own. So this is what's going on, I think, in Augustine. But what interests me much more is how restricted Porphyry was in the concessions he made to these bits of superstition. That's what really impresses me, because it's so unlike some of his successors. You see, one successor was Iamblichus, who was a tremendous enthusiast for priestly rites and the effects, let's just say, the effects of priestly power. Tremendous enthusiast for that. And he passed this on to the Athenian school. Mercifully, he didn't pass it on to Ammonius in the 6th century Alexandrian school, who went back to something much more like Porphyry. Now, it's very interesting what Augustine says, and I've written it out here, from the City of God 10:9, which is actually one of Julian's messages, I'm sure. But reading the bit at the bottom, page 6, where he says, he's talking about this theurgy, as it's called, which is priestly ritual, which brings about all these wonderful things. Porphyry, says Augustine, goes so far as to promise some sort of purification of the soul by means of theurgy, but purification only, quite a low level of improvement. Though to be sure he is reluctant to commit himself, and seems to blush with embarrassment in his argument. On the other hand, he denies that this art offers to anyone a way of return to God, because God's an intellectual being, and it's only the emotions that could be purified. You won't do anything for the intellect, the really important thing. With these priestly rituals. And so one can observe him maintaining two contradictory positions, complains Augustine, and wavering between a superstition, which amounts to the sin of blasphemy, and a philosophical standpoint. saying that the art is useful for the purification of one part of the soul, skipping to the next underlined bit. This is not the intellectual element by which is perceived the truth of intelligible realities, the platonic ones, which have no resemblance to material substances. It is the spiritual part of the soul by which it apprehends the images of material things, Porphyry declares, that by means of certain theurgic consecrations, which are called teletai, the spiritual element of the soul is put into a proper condition. It's getting you to purified virtue with acceleration, but that's still pretty low down virtue. It's not yet intellectual virtue. And for intellect, you actually got to have philosophy. But philosophy's tops. It's very interesting. It's very different from the Anglican afternoon routine in school. I think I've probably said enough. But we'll hear much more about it, I expect. Gillian, I've just put the Greek, because I haven't actually found a convenient translation of the passage from the Christian Eusebius, which is one of the fragments of on statues. But he takes a view on statues which is rather a downgrading of the supernatural. Because he says, look, you may see people like ourselves, actually, apparently worshipping statues, but that's actually not what we're doing at all. Statues are merely something which are symbols of the wonderful divine powers you see in the beauties of nature. It's almost like, Wordsworth's naturalism is talking about, the beauties of nature, all the way up to the heavens, but even down here, the beauties of nature show the power of the divine. And that's what we're thinking about. The statues are merely an aid. And so, many times we find him downplaying the bits that would be objectionable to Augustine, and the bits which were all too dear to some of his successors, though not, I'm happy to say, to the late Alexandrian school under Ammonius. Now, before I come to the logic, one more thing in this sort of sphere, the religious questions he asks. Because he asked very searching, but entirely respectful questions about Egyptian religion, on which his junior, who'd heard his lectures, Iamblichus, was so keen. I've been to the beautiful site where Iamblichus taught in Syria. I spent a week with the archaeologists there. I reinterpreted the mosaics, because I thought only one of them was the philosophy school's mosaic. I argued that the other one was clearly the rhetoric school's mosaic. You don't have ladies taking their clothes off in the philosophical mosaic. There's a very good reason why you did on the rhetoric mosaic. I won't go into that now, but these mosaics were installed by the Emperor Julian after Iamblichus' death, because Iamblichus was his favorite Neoplatonist philosopher with all his priestly powers, and he was taught by a pupil of Iamblichus, or a pupil of a pupil of Iamblichus. Now, Porphyry, in his scholarly, but always curious and interested way, asks a lot of questions, writing a respectful letter to Anibo, the name of an Egyptian priest, saying, why do you do this ritual? Why do you do that ritual? All this sort of thing. And here's the one on page 7 of the handout. Porphyry is asking, this is recorded by Iamblichus, who gives a haughty reply. Porphyry asks, so then you ask, how comes it that many theurgical, priestly, ritualistic procedures are directed towards them, that's towards the gods, as if they were subject to passions? Well, my reply to that, says Iamblichus, is that the question is asked out of an inexperience of sacred mystagogy. What this younger man who heard Porphyry's lectures is doing, he's replying to him, and whereas the letter had been addressed as a letter to an Egyptian priest, Anibo, he replies, as it's coming from Abamon, which I'm told in Egyptian means father of God. So it's a piece of one-upmanship from the start. Actually, the phrase father of God had been used by Porphyry himself I think in the sentences, I think if you look through the bits I've underlined in the sentences, you will find that phrase used by Porphyry. Yes, yes, you can, on page 5. End of the first paragraph on page 5. One who practices the paradigmatic virtues, that is, the virtues corresponding to the forms which are paradigms, Plato's forms which are paradigms, is a father of the gods. So this phrase is known to Porphyry, but not used of himself, of course. The Iamblichus uses it of himself. And now, among the many replies, is this very interesting one. Porphyry has asked him, why do you have religious rituals setting up phallic images on page 7 and making obscene utterances? Are the gods interested in sex or emotion? And for once, he quotes Aristotle's theory of the cathartic effect of comedy and tragedy, something which had disappeared from the scene amazingly after Aristotle wrote his Poetics for 600 years until you reach this passage. It really is amazing it could have disappeared. I think it may be partly because the Stoics had another way of dealing with it, of dealing with the Poetics by saying, look here, theatre doesn't arouse emotion anyhow. It only arouses what they call pre-passions or first movements. There were other answers other than Aristotle's. But this is the first time, at least, so Richard Jenko has claimed, and I've not found anything to the contrary, that it's mentioned again. And the answer is, you don't understand, Porphyry. And the thing is that arousing a little bit of sex of emotion can actually glorify you of it by reducing it, purging you of it. And that's how he's understanding it. Now, Porphyry also addressed questions to the Christian religion and asked them about their things, and also about the Zoroastrians when he tried to prove that certain texts claimed to be Zoroastrian were bogus. Against the Christians, we've only got fragments, and I think it's very controversial. I hope perhaps you will hear more about this. What are genuine fragments and so on? They come all come from being Christians, I think, probably. But he must have made some pretty good points. I'm sure we're going to hear about it from Gillian in City of God, Book 10. But just two remarks. First of all, he argued that the Book of Daniel was not a book of prophecy, because it was written 400 years later than supposed, and so after the events supposed to have been prophesied. And I'm told that modern scholars of the New Testament agree with Porphyry. And secondly, he argued, given his interest in animals, that Christ wasn't very nice to the Gadarene swine. How do you say he's got a point there? You know, I suppose he made them gallop over a cliff to their deaths. Isn't very nice, was it? So, whether it was respectful or not, I can't tell. I don't know if anybody has an opinion on that, because, of course, the reports we have of it are outraged, what he's saying is simple to tell. Now, I have to say something about logic, because he made the centerpiece of his, a centerpiece of his philosophy of Aristotle, as a commentator on Aristotle, was Aristotle's logic. Of course, we have lost his commentaries on the physics and on other things. So, if only we had them, we might have a more balanced picture. But his successors, especially Ammonius and Alexander, made the logic very central and praised him for it. So, it's important to talk a little about the logic. I'll start with the notion of universals as opposed to particulars. And I'd like to tell you first, because it's rather exciting, about his largest commentary, and probably his most influential work of all, his largest commentary on Aristotle's Categories, which had been almost totally lost until 2005, and was translated last year. And the translation is here, on page 8. this really large commentary, which we can now see is very influential on the successors, but also tells us about some of the earliest commentators on Aristotle, and we knew quite little about 5 years ago, 8 years ago. This text was invisible to the naked eye. Heiberg, the great mathematical scholar of mathematics, and one of the translators of commentaries on Aristotle, owned this manuscript. And he was aware that there was writing at one end of it. And he was aware that these were little bits of Archimedes. By the use of many different lights, a succession of teams, at first led by late Robert Sharples, started by Nigel Wilson in this university, managed to decipher virtually the whole of the lost work of Archimedes on floating bodies. It has been published in Greek and in translation. It's a wonderful book about it by Reverend Netz and his administrative companion suddenly is appearing for me. They call it Archimedes Codex. Fascinating book. It was all deciphered. To me, it was amazing. I mean, I went to the committee meetings, but Nigel Wilson would stand in front of everybody. First of all, they sent us experimental multicolored computer reproductions, asking us which mixture of lights made it most readable. Well, to me, it was all colored dots anyhow. when various people could see this stuff, had given their answers, then on enormous screens we were shown this work. And what would happen was that Nigel Wilson would stand in front of us, a little to the side, slightly punched, motionless for 10 minutes. And then he'd say, "I see a sigma." And I would look at him and see, what? The only word I really saw was the word Aristoteles, because I'd been trained to jump whenever I see that word. So I jumped. Otherwise, I thought I really wasn't contributing to this exercise. By the time I came back, the final team, I'm very sad to say, Bob Travers had died by then, but the final team, David Sidley, Marvin Rushed, who gave the lectures last term, and Ricardo Caradona was coming in, actually translated practically the whole of what survives. Only 7 pages out of 400 and something, but actually pretty interesting. Now let's just look very briefly at a little bit of those pages. My first remarks on logic will be on universals as opposed to particulars. There was a funny little puzzle, and we are told, by Simplex, is that what Porphyry did in his great commentary, which had been almost totally lost, was take up all the objections there had ever been to Aristotle's categories. And some of them were produced by this man, Nicostricus, whom I've circled. And Nicostricus had produced the following argument. Aristotle's logic is all wrong because, according to Aristotle, this should be a valid syllogism. Socrates is a man. Man is a species. Therefore, Socrates is a species. Well, now, we are learning many, many lost works of Boethus have been discovered, a large number actually, by Marvin Rashid single-handed in the last 8 years. This one was discovered, of course, by the team. Boethus has a particular answer, Now, to understand Boethus' answer, which we didn't know before, you have to see what Simplicius says about him at the top of page 8. According to Simplicius, Boethus, I'm not talking about the great Boethius, the Christian, I'm talking about the man who invented line-by-line commentary on Aristotle. He invented it. He said, we should comment line-by-line on Aristotle. He's the first person who said it. And that was the model of the best commentaries, line-by-line. Now, Boethus, however, provides a solution for this too. In the first place, he says universals are not even real in hypostasy, according to Aristotle. And even if they were, they are not a determined thing. They are not a something. Yet Aristotle said, in something, in his definition of what a substance is, he says, a substance is never in something, because it's always a subject, not a predicate. Therefore, that which is in something cannot be in a universal sense. An example would be animal, which is the genus of human, and therefore the genus under which Socrates falls, can't be said to be in something, because there's a sense in which the genus is indeed in the species, but the species isn't a thing, because it's not a substance, because it isn't a subject. And that's the criterion for substance within the categories, not in the metaphysics. All right, so Boethius doesn't think that universals have reality. He thinks, and this was relevant to one of Marwan's lectures to us last term, Boethius thinks that all remarks about man as a rational animal should be rephrased, and Aristotle thinks this in the Symmetrics, as every man is a rational animal. Then you're not dealing with a universal, it seems. Man is a rational animal. No, you rewrite it as every man. You say you're only dealing with individuals, and then you are dealing with individual substances. But there isn't such a substance as man. That's just nothing. Well, not nothing. But it's, well, I think it probably is nothing, because it's not a something. And so, Boethius' answer is, animal is predicated of man only as if of a subject, because there isn't a true subject there, namely, man, because man isn't a true subject, because it can be said of Socrates. As a matter of fact, Porphyry may have had a different answer from the one that we're told here, or at least Dexippus provided a different answer, and Dexippus is very often copying Porphyry. Porphyry produced a very interesting idea, an important and influential idea, that we should distinguish between names and names of names. Species is not the name of a thing, it's the name of a name. You see, man might be thought by Porphyry to be the name of a thing, because he does think it's the way in which man is a real thing. But species isn't the name of a thing, it's the name of a name. For Porphyry, it's a second imposition of names, treating it as if it was historical. It says, first humans gave names directly to things, and then when they got more sophisticated, they gave names to names. That was a second imposition. Quite a useful idea, actually, to say, the reason why this is a bad argument is that species is the name of a name, and the argument would only go through if it was dealing with names of things. All right, so much for that for that little bit of logic, but there's a little bit more on universals to say, and this is why it'd be very interesting to hear both from Erismann later in the term and from Ricardo Caradonna. I think Ricardo first, and then Erismann, have reversed what had been said about Porphyry's universals. Because they argue, and this is now the bottom of the left-hand side of page 8, they argue that if you talk about the genus, for Porphyry, not Boethius of course, but for Porphyry, genera are quite real. To read the penultimate thing on the left-hand side of page 8, accidents subsist principally on individuals, subsist principally on individuals, whereas genera and species are prior by nature to individual substances, and the type of priority is this, that he's been talking about. It's a, can you have one without the other question? And his idea is that you can't have individuals if you don't have genera. It's probably the idea that animal, along with rational, differential, make Socrates what he is. And so you couldn't have things like Socrates, the individuals, without genera. They're part of what makes him what he is. That, part of Porphyry's view, very much not Boethius's view, but Porphyry's view. And then he uses another word, archi, or origin, in the second last line, in the bottom. And this is all, in a work called his Isagoge, or Introduction to Aristotle. The final words are, for such a genus is a sort of archi, sort of source for the items under it. Well, that word archi is important. It suggests the genus does a very realistic job. It's a source of Socrates. I suggest it makes him what he is. It's a very realistic view of genus. Now, that's very unlike what people had said earlier. And indeed, perhaps they were influenced by that great Ammonius in the 6th century, who wrote a commentary on this work. You see, he's the first man to have written an introduction to Aristotle called the Isagoge. And Ammonius, the founder of the 6th century, or late 5th century school in Alexandria, really fantastic brilliant man, wrote a commentary on the Isagoge, which is how you started philosophy. Students would start philosophy by reading Porphyry's Isagoge, but actually first reading Ammonius' commentary on the Isagoge, and before that, a prelude to Ammonius' commentary on the Isagoge. That's how you start doing philosophy. Read this prelude. It'll define what philosophy is. In Ammonius, it'll give 6 definitions of what philosophy is, including 2 of Porphyry's favorites, assimilation to God, which of course is taken out of the Theaetetus, and preparing for death, which of course is taken out of the Phaedo. Preparing for death by separating your body, the body from the soul. Now, Ammonius thought, because of the use of the word enaia, which means concept, he thought that these universals of Boethius, of Porphyry, he thought they were just concepts in the mind. And this was also thought by Ebbersen, Tim Ebbersen, wonderful scholar, especially of 12th century commentaries, and by Jonathan Barnes in his valuable book on Porphyry's Isagoge. But Caradona and Erisman have reversed this by the sort of passages I put here for you, and perhaps you'll hear more from them about this. But no, one use of the term genus, one kind of genus, is very real. It's a source which makes Socrates what he is, helps to make Socrates what he is. But there is talk of a different type of genus, which is indeed an abstraction, an abstracted concept in the mind, only it comes in a different and later work, Porphyry on Ptolemy's Harmonics, and I put it on the right-hand side of page 8, where the soul draws off the forms where I've underlined it from matter, receives them into herself, and in some fashion disengages them from matter, and recovers the forms from sensation, and imagination plays a big role here. Just the bits I've underlined. It stores the form in the soul. And he does use the word universal in the bottom part of the page, only once actually. But at one point the word universal is used in section 32, has passed to the universal via the concept for the non-material storage of the form. I won't go further, but that's where you do get the idea of a universal being a stored concept. So he does have both types of universal in mind. Just 2 more things on logic. Individuals for Porphyry were bundles of qualities. That comes out in the last passage. Oh, I'm very sorry, I must have cut off the place where that is, I can tell you. And individuals are bundles of qualities, according to the Isagoge 7, lines 16 to 24. So things like this are called individuals because each is composed of distinctive qualities, a conglomeration of which would never come into being identical in anything else. You are composed of qualities. Nothing about matter which has the qualities. You are just composed of distinctive qualities, the bundle of which the aphorismer is distinctive. Where does he get this from? Other people have said from the Stoics, but I think both the Stoics and Porphyry got it from Plato's Theaetetus, which I put at the top. Plato says to Theaetetus, "You couldn't think of me, Socrates, unless you think of the snubness of nose, the particularly distinctive snubness of nose, and such characteristics of which I consist." Well, actually, it's your shape of nose and other characters of which you consist, as if you just consisted of these. And the word aphorismer is used earlier in the Theaetetus, and the other terminology as well of idiom, distinctive, unique. So I think both the Stoics and Porphyry get these ideas out of Plato's Theaetetus. Well, that's perhaps enough. I will skip the bit about the differentia on the right-hand side of page 9, and I'm almost coming to the end now. But I'll just say that this is why we get what's called a tree of Porphyry. He says at the end, on the left-hand side of page 9, the individual atomon is said only of one of the particulars to catenaros, as if Socrates could be said of a particular, a bare particular. Socrates is an individual, and he can be said of a particular. How is this? Well, you see, if Socrates is just a bundle of qualities, an aphorismer of qualities, which no one else has, or indeed could have, then it does make sense on that view to say that Socrates, as this bundle of qualities, could be said of a particular. But this is a very unusual view that other people haven't followed in logic. That the, well, some have, that it is a modern view. You do find it in some modern people, but it's not a popular view in logic. It does recur from time to time. That an individual is just a bundle of qualities, no matter there, no subject of qualities. And then this bundle of qualities could be said of a sort of bare particular, which in itself has no qualities at all. This is a distinctive piece of logic, even if not a favored one. Well, I think I'll just say one last thing, because we get such a personal picture of Porphyry. And one of the personal things we see in the personal struggle he had to get accepted in the Dionysus seminar, he was inclined to commit suicide, and Plotinus talked him out of it and sent him away for a holiday to Sicily, rather a long holiday. He tells us that in the life of Plotinus. And both Plotinus and Porphyry wrote about suicide, and we know why Porphyry thought we shouldn't commit suicide, because it's in two places. And I put those two places on page 10. First of all, in On Abstinence, now the philosopher will not take himself out, exagai here, I thought. That's the Greek who commits suicide. The philosopher will not take himself out by violence, for by being violent to himself, he remains nonetheless in the place from which he is forcing himself away. That's actually in the Phaedo. You'll hang around graveyards like a spook. But he will not think he is doing something that makes the difference, that makes no difference. When it thickens his chains, he'll be more bound to earthly things. So that's one sort of argument. And then, in the sentences from Dylan's translation, okay, section 9, death is of two sorts. The one is the generally recognized one involving the loosing of the body from the soul. The other is that of the philosophers, involving the soul loosing itself from the body, like Socrates in the Phaedo. Well, so they're not the same thing. Don't get them muddled up. One is good, the other's bad. I leave out the last two things. I said the last bit would be on suicide, birth, and death. But I'll tell you where you can find them if you want to find them. Recently there has been translated the embryological work of Porphyry to Gallus, which is rather interesting because it gives a much bigger role to the mother, and because Plotinus had been a bit muddled. Plotinus had been a bit muddled because, on one story of embryology, the parents contribute all the features, the logoi, to the offspring. But that doesn't quite fit with Plotinus's other idea, that the world soul sketches a sort of body into the earth, and then the individual soul, which is being reincarnated, comes down and performs something actually not a visual like a sketch, performs a little dance, a dancing the sort of character it wants to have, and that's the way it gets its body, using the sketch that the world soul has put into the earth, and by dancing its character, it creates a body for itself. Now, this doesn't seem to leave out the parents, so it's a bit undecided. So what we've got in Porphyry is rather interesting. He's trying to get a consistent story, and he tells it in three parts. One, the father. The seed is provided by the father, as in Aristotle, and the seed is blended with the father's nature. But when the mother is impregnated, then the fetus is blended with the mother's nature. So no wonder people look like their mothers, something which Aristotle didn't manage to explain. Good for Porphyry. And then finally, when the baby is born, the individual soul comes down and takes over. So at least he's got a consistent story, a three-part story, with a role for the mother. And the last thing I'll say, and this was translated and beautifully explained by the translation is by James Wilbury, to Gaurus in embryology. The other thing on which people are puzzled is whether he believed you could be reincarnated as an animal. They all believed in reincarnation. Because Augustine, in Dillian's message, so if you've got booked in, though not always friendly to Porphyry, firmly says, no, he didn't believe in that rubbish. He didn't think he could be reincarnated as an animal. But the bishop Nemesius, wonderful source of information about philosophy of mind in the late Neoplatonists, Nemesius, or early Neoplatonists, Nemesius says that Porphyry did believe in reincarnation. How come these two different verdicts? A conjecture I made is that because Plotinus, the teacher's account, was so sort of muddled up, a bit of this and a bit of that, Plotinus's account was that either the individual soul didn't go into the animal's body at all, or else it was sort of halfway there, it was present without being present. He told a funny story. In the case where a human soul is animating a beast, either it doesn't actually enter at all, or it is present, but without being present. Now, once again, Porphyry, tremendously sort of worrying scholar, wants to get it right. I feel rather sympathetic, actually. He tells a story which was reinterpreted in two different ways. Well, perhaps he was trying to be faithful to his teacher, Plotinus, who really had got two totally different stories. But I will say one last thing. James Wilberding also translated in that same book as an end piece a fragment of Porphyry on the Republic describing the myth of Ur. Now, in the myth of Ur, it's all about choosing your next life. And so since you're allowed to choose your next life, God is not responsible for what goes wrong. You want to be stinkingly rich, so you have a miserable life, and it's entirely your fault because you chose. That's the story. And apparently, Porphyry said, in this fragment of his about the myth of Ur, he said that you can actually choose to be an animal. So he must have changed his mind from time to time. That is absolutely straightforwardly clear. As it wasn't clear to Nemesius and Augustine. Sorry to have gone over time.